You know, I think for me, it's more curiosity. Whenever I see something, I'm probably a problem solver to a fault. So if somebody points out a problem, I want to solve it immediately, or I want to I'm curious as to, well, what's the root cause, or how might we navigate around it, over it, under it, through it? And so there's a level of curiosity. So there isn't necessarily a tool or something, but I allow myself to step back and say, okay, let's look at this. What's the root problem, and how can we change that? But it can be dangerous. I say every gift that you have is resourceful, but there's a line in the sand where it can become unresourceful, because there are times where I have too many balls in the air, too many problems I'm trying to solve. The technique that I have found is that I have to get laser focused on one thing and go deep.
Monica, welcome to Tools, Talents, and Techniques. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm loving it. And thank you for just giving me space on your platform.
I could not think of a better person to have on the show, especially going through your profile and your experience. There's so many different things that we can talk about, from diversity, technology, startup, everything. So before we jump in, could you just briefly give a thumbnail of who you are and what it is that you do?
Absolutely. Well, my name is Monica Marquez. I'm co-founder of Flipwork, where we help organizations and leaders really reimagine and reinvent how people and AI work together. And so my background spans, more than two decades of companies, working at companies like Goldman Sachs, Ernst & Young, Google, where I focused on a plethora of things, from talent management, leadership development, but all in all, that through line was really helping people thrive inside systems of change and complex systems. Every one of these organizations had its own kind of culture, its own systemic kind of barriers, those types of things. And so really always focused on large scale transformation, and it all honed into helping people. So that's just a little bit about me and what I do.
Let's go back to the origin story. So when you were growing up, what did you want to do when you became an adult? Like, what was your interest? What was your major in college?
Really great question. And it's not linear. It's a little bit of zigzag everywhere, because I grew up in a really small town in West Texas, and it's oil country, Midland, Odessa, Texas. But my dad was in the military. So kind of my early years moved around, but I went to junior high and high school in West Texas. And to be quite honest, my frame of reference was very limited to success in my small town. Was you become a doctor, a lawyer, or a petroleum engineer. And so those were the people who were successful, who were affluent, who had the big homes. And so in my mind, I was going to become a doctor. So I went off to college, majored in biology, because I was going to be a doctor, because that's what I thought was it. It wasn't until I got to college that that aperture widened and I realized, oh my God, there's so many other things that you could be doing. But of course, I still stuck the course because that's all I knew and it's all my family knew. And it wasn't until my senior year in college, when I was applying for medical school, that I had this mentor who I had to work my entire college career. And I was working for the vice president of student affairs on campus. It was a work study kind of program. And he became a really great mentor to me. And I remember Dr. Ewalt coming to me and he said, Monica, I had asked him to write a recommendation letter for med school. And he was like, absolutely. But then he sat down, he said, why do you want to be a doctor? And I'm like, well, because no one really had ever asked me that. And I was like, because that's, what I'm supposed to become. It's what my family and I have always seen as being successful. And he's like, yes. He's like, but in the 4 years you've been here, I've seen you do all of these other things where you light up, you've been a leader, you were in the student government, you were the leader in the Hispanic Student Society, you worked in my office, you were the student liaison on the Board of Regents board, like all of these things. And he was just like, have you thought about doing this type of role? And that's where I had this crossroads, and I realized really quickly that there were other opportunities out there. And this was the first time I had someone really pointing out my zone of genius of like, what is it that you really do naturally, really, really well? And why don't you do more of that? And he said, I know you're super smart. I see your GPA. He's like, but I don't see you lighting up about biology and about doing all these other things. And so that's where I kind of stopped. And I said, what do I want to do? And I ended up getting a master's degree in higher education administration, more around adult learning, adult leadership, and all of those things that what I was doing on campus anyway. And so I ended up getting my master's, and then I packed up my bags and moved to New York City. Started off in academia working at NYU, and was doing a lot of that, of like helping individuals immerse themselves in other countries, study abroad programs to help people widen their frame of reference, because that's really kind of what that aha moment that I had. And before I knew it, I was being interviewed by Goldman Sachs because they had started an office of global leadership and diversity, because the work that I was doing was actually helping people build cultural competency. And companies were getting very, very big into emerging markets and doing work in other countries. And people needed to increase their cultural competency in order to do business in other countries. And so that's how I ended up in corporate, and really using a lot of my natural kind of zone of genius of helping people develop and learn and transform, and, you know, really kind of like broaden their frame of reference. And that's what I kind of, the through line was, that's what I started doing. And so that's what changed the trajectory of my career.
So from the conversation that you had with your mentor,
yeah,
how long was it in between that gap from the original conversation to you changing your major? Because that's a big shift,
yeah,
in what you're doing. How did you go through that, think through that process?
I mean, it was one of those where it was a bit of a juxtaposition where I was like, whoa, wait a minute, like a little bit of an identity crisis of like, I thought this entire time I was going to be this doctor. But looking back on the 4 years of college and all of the things that I actually loved doing, all of the extracurricular activities where I thrived, I never, for whatever reason, thought about this could be somewhat of a career path. And it, so I really had to sit down and go talk to my parents and say, hey, like, I've applied to medical school, but I have another option. I might apply to this master's program that will help me develop more of what I had been doing organically my entire 4 years. And so my biggest fear was that I was going to disappoint my parents, because I was like all along going to be this doctor. And so there was probably a couple of weeks where I was like, okay, I'm just going to apply to both programs, and maybe the decision will be made for me. Maybe I won't get into med school and into the other program, or vice versa. But I got into both. So then it was one of those things of really kind of thinking about, you know, what did I enjoy doing? And I really had to start kind of looking at the upside and the downside, and which downside could I live with. And so I remember thinking, okay, I'll go to 4 years of med school, 4 years of residency, knowing myself as being this high achiever, I'd have to do some sort of specialization. So that's probably another at least 2 years of specialization. It'd probably be 10 more years before I was going to be able to do what I really wanted to do in the medical field. And then it was like, or I could do this master's degree. And it was a bit of a non-traditional master's degree. It was a 3-year program opposed to a 2-year program. And I was like, but I could get really, really into doing my work and having impact in 3 years. And it was really kind of aligned to some of the things that I was already doing. So I ended up deciding to go with the master's degree. But yeah, there was probably about a 2-week period where I was really struggling and contemplating of what I wanted to do, but really doing that exercise of upside, downside, can I live with the downside? And part of me was like, I don't know if I can live for 10 years grinding and doing schoolwork and not really necessarily working and making money for another 10 years. I really, you know, I'm a little bit more of a impatient person. It was like, no, I want to be able to have impact sooner. And so I chose the other
path. Yeah. Well, 2 weeks to make a decision that completely flipped your life is a short period of time.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you, I believe you said the first job that was this Goldman Sachs out of
my first job was
college,
actually at NYU. And so I was working in academia, working in NYU, building out study abroad programs, partnering with business schools, getting people to kind of go to other countries and immerse themselves in other cultures and build that cultural competency, which was really kind of this idea of making sure that people realize that you have to be cognizant of how other cultures, be respectful of other cultures. You can't just go do business, you know, the American way in another country, or you're just not going to get very far. So it was a little bit of that.
Okay. And then you went to Goldman Sachs.
Then I went to Goldman Sachs. Yes. While I was there, it just so happened that, and I'm dating myself many years ago, but that's when a lot of companies really started focusing on this idea around diversity, equity, inclusion, around really building cultural competency to be able to do work in emerging markets in other countries. And so this idea that, you know, you can't just send people who don't really understand the other culture, how do you solve that? By two ways. One, increasing people's, you know, cultural competency, or recruiting people from those countries or that have those backgrounds to be able to do work in those places. And so I kind of ran the gamut of, you know, coming in and focusing on some diversity recruiting, of trying to bring in more women and more diverse professionals in the organization, so that, you know, the idea was always tied to the bottom line. It was never intended, never was a check the box, we need to have representation. It was more than that. It was like, how are we going to do business in foreign countries, or in a, you know, or with, you know, diverse populations, if we don't understand those diverse populations and we don't have people from those diverse populations working with us.
And around what year is this? I know before you said that you're dating yourself, so
yeah.
I want to be cognizant of that.
But it was early. Yeah, definitely, it was okay. early 2000s, probably around 2004, 2005-ish, around that time. And then so that's when I kind of went into the corporate world and left academia and really never looked back. And to be quite honest, funny story is you talk about limited frame of reference. You know, I grew up thinking I was going to be this doctor. I got my bachelor's in biology, minor in organic chemistry. And so I was very much STEM. And then I went this route, which was more academia, you know, really helping learning development theory, adult learning, those types of things. Then when I got into the corporate world, this was like a foreign kind of just totally different language. It was like, I didn't have an MBA. I didn't know the lingo. So I had to pick it up really quickly. But the joke was, is that when I had a really good friend of me, she was the lead recruiter at Goldman Sachs. And she was like, she met me and we knew each other as friends. And she came to my Cinco de Mayo party at my house. And she said, hey, I think there's a role for you at Goldman Sachs. My first reaction was, who's Goldman Sachs? And she was like, what? And she was like, you're in New York City. You don't know who Goldman Sachs is. And I'm like, no, like I'm in academia. Like I don't know. She's like, do you have any friends that went to B school? And of course the lingo, I was like, B school. And she was like, business school. Do you have anybody who has an MBA? And I'm like, yeah, I have tons of friends who have MBAs. She was like, call them up, tell them you have an opportunity at Goldman Sachs and see what they tell you. And so I remember calling a friend up and I'm like, hey, Stephanie, I was like, I have this opportunity at Goldman Sachs, but I'm not quite sure. And she was like, wait, what? And she was like, hang up the phone, call the recruiter, say yes, I don't care what the role is, and then call me back and tell me what it is. So I was like, okay, there's something here. So I remember calling and saying, okay, like, let me see this through. Let me interview. And before I knew it, I was getting the offer. And I was a little afraid, because then the only thing I could attribute to Goldman Sachs was Wolf of Wall Street, right? I made the mistake of going and watching this movie and saying, okay, maybe I don't want to be part of this culture. And they were like, no, that's Hollywood. You should definitely try it. And so I remember my boss at the time at NYU was like, listen, you don't pass up an opportunity like this. And so he said, let's make a date 6 months from now. You take this job. If you don't like it and it turns out to be like Wolf of Wall Street, he's like, you could just come back here. We'll have lunch in 6 months. And if you say, I don't like it, you come back. And I was like, okay, that was my security blanket. And so I took the job. 6 months later, I had lunch with him. I was like, I'm having the time of my life, and I never looked back.
That's amazing. Do you feel, looking back on it now, were there things that the organization, was there already a department around this, and they were like, hey, we need somebody to help with this, or did they bring you in to lead it and build it?
They had already started. I mean, there already had been. It was probably fairly new. It was an Office of Global Leadership and Diversity. And so it was in the kind of infancy stages of what does that even look like? And so at first it started off like we start with recruiting, and I was part of that. I started a lot of the recruiting programs where it was really trying to lead really innovative pioneering programs. So one of the programs that I created and pioneered was the Goldman Sachs Returnship Program, which was really creating opportunities for professionals, especially women who were trying to re-enter the workforce. Because we all know that in some of these industries that are very cutthroat, you know, you get into an organization like that, but if you take a career break or you decide to push pause and you have a gap in your resume, trying to get back in is really, really hard. But what I realized is that there was a huge talent pool that was being untapped, where a lot of these women were Ivy League graduates, came in, had been working for 4, 5, 6 years in organizations, and because of personal responsibilities, decided to take a break for childcare reasons, for elder care reasons, for whatever it may be. They had other responsibilities that took priority. They had every intention of coming back, and no one was really taking them up on that because of the gap on the resume. And so the idea was how do we get some more of this amazing talent who are ready to come back with 110% and mitigate the risk for hiring managers? And so we created the Returnship Program that really helped women come back in a kind of 10-week period. And for managers, we said, look, we do this with, you know, young kids who come out of college who know nothing about, you know, the world of finance, and you test them out for 12 weeks and then you extend offers to them. Same thing, but you're getting now more seasoned professionals who already know it and they're going to hit the ground running. And I'm really excited to say, like, that program is still in existence at Goldman Sachs. I mean, they have had returnships now I launched it in 2008 and it's still going strong. And so they've been able to place thousands and thousands of people into full-time roles from this program. So did a little bit of that. And then we started realizing, okay, once you get them there, how do you train them and help them navigate the corporate culture and keep growing and thriving in the organization? So I moved over into talent management type of roles of really making sure that people were advancing and developing. And so that's where my true background started, you know, playing out and really leveraging what my expertise was in higher education.
There are a few things that you've said so far in this conversation that really are indicative and really a testament to who you are. You said, I realized, and then you build. And yes, from what I know of that and the next steps of things, like that, you can have an idea and then you can start to build on that in a manner that is parallel and related to the things that you're passionate about. Could you talk about where that comes from? Is that something that you're conscious of, that you're like, this is who I am? I'm a builder. I'm a creator. Mm-hmm. I'm an idea person, but I'm a doer.
Yeah, I think it is a little bit innate in a sense. I didn't realize that it was a superpower until I actually gifted myself the time to step back to ask myself, what am I really good at? And paying attention to what people were coming to me for and what people were telling me I was good at. But it's those things where a lot of the times it's the pain points that even I've experienced. Like a lot of the times where I was coming into an industry or an organization where I didn't have anybody who looked like me, and trying to figure out, like, how do I define what does success look like here and how do I emulate that? And then getting to a point where learning from my mistakes, like I assimilated too much to where it felt like it doesn't feel like me. And so then realizing I needed to kind of really think about acculturating opposed to assimilating. It's like success looks like this at this organization, but I am not, for lack of a better term, like a pale male from Yale. So I can't pretend like I'm a pale male from Yale. I have to still be myself. So how do I acculturate, and how does success look like me in this space? And so it's like, how do I transfer that knowledge to other people? Because I did a lot of trial and error. And how do you make sure that you transfer that knowledge so someone else doesn't have to waste the time and can actually have a little bit of traction faster than you did in that organization? So those things were a lot of those realizations of, like, what is the pain point and how do you help remove some of that friction for the next generation or the next person? And so those were some of the things where really eyeballing and stepping back and say, what are the pain points and how do I take whatever resources I have and try to make something happen. And so that's where a lot of the times my friends, my endearingly, my nickname is MacGyver. And so usually, you know, it's always been like you MacGyver things and can like figure things out. And so that's what I have found that I do all the time. When I start seeing change or see the writing on the wall that things are changing, things are happening, it's just like, how do I kind of like hit that head on and then help other people navigate it as well?
What does that process look like for you when you have that realization? Are there any tools or techniques? Like that's why the show is called what it is. That you go through a process. Is it journaling? Is it talking to your friends? Is it going for a walk? Like, what does that process look like for you?
You know, I think for me, it's more curiosity. Whenever I see something, I'm probably a problem solver to a fault. So if somebody points out a problem, I want to solve it immediately, or I want to I'm curious as to, well, what's the root cause, or how might we like navigate around it, over it, under it, through it. And so there's a level of curiosity. So there isn't necessarily a tool or something, but I allow myself to step back and say, okay, let's look at this. Like, let's, you know, what's the root problem, and how can we change that? But it can be dangerous. I say every gift that you have is resourceful, but there's a line in the sand where it can become unresourceful, because there are times where I have too many balls in the air, like too many problems I'm trying to solve. And the technique that I have found is that I have to get laser focused on one thing and go deep. Otherwise, I'm trying to put out too many fires. So it's one of those things where I really try to think about what's going to have the most impact, and how can I make sure that what do I bring? Where is my zone of genius? Where is my superpower that I know that this is where I can do some high value work and not get caught up in doing things that necessarily are going to dilute, you know, my impact. And so it's a little bit of, you know, stepping back, and it's really the reflection. And sometimes that's hard to do, because I'm let's just attack it. Let's do it. Let's go. Like, I try not to think twice. I'm someone who tries to move forward despite any uncertainty, which can sometimes, you know, become kind of your Achilles heel. But I've learned that giving yourself a moment to pause, think, and say, how do I pivot? Where do I pivot? And then give myself permission to fail. Like, okay, let's try it. And then let's just test and learn until we, you know, figure out how we can replicate the outcome over and over.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I know the type. Intimately, I know the type of just kind of leap before you look and shoot before you aim. I know the
exactly.
Type. And you're right. And somebody told me there's an expression, and I'm sure there's other iterations of it, but what warms you burns you. I want to make sure we save enough time in this episode to talk about what you're currently doing.
Yeah.
The Latinas in Tech, you're on the board there. There's some other things that you're doing. Tell me about these next things that you're doing and the impact that you've made and the challenges that you've had to face and overcome.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think, as I mentioned, the through line in my career has always been about helping people, helping a lot of the times marginalized groups, whether it was women, minorities, or just groups that really needed some additional support or guidance to kind of navigate. And when I was wearing one of my hats, when I was head of diversity recruiting at Goldman, I got very, very involved managing a lot of the relationships with these nonprofits like ALPHA, which is Association of Latin Professionals, you know, Latinas in Tech, a lot of these, you know, programs that help really identify women, minorities, others, and help expose them to areas like STEM or the finance world. A little bit of the person I was, the person who didn't know that there were other jobs outside of becoming a doctor, lawyer, engineer, the person who didn't know who Goldman Sachs was and those types of things, of how do you get people exposure or visibility into these worlds and opportunities sooner rather than later. And so I always found, you know, a soft spot in my heart for these organizations. And after I moved on from Goldman and I went to, you know, do some, you know, leadership roles at Bank of America, Ernst & Young, Google, I stayed in contact with these organizations and started volunteering, speaking, you know, for their conferences, and ultimately became a board member for both Latinas in Tech and Association for Latin Professionals to help make sure that, you know, support and continue the mission of really helping more and more individuals just have proximity and understand their options and get them thinking early, and even maybe talking at the dinner table with family members about these opportunities. Because me growing up, we never sat at the dinner table and talked about Wall Street or the economy or any of these things? And how do you help people start to get exposure to these sooner rather than later? Latinas in Tech is very, very focused on exactly the name, right, of technology. I think you and I were talking, you yourself in some of your ventures where you have this tech startup and you start to realize when you step back, whoa, I'm like a single person. I don't see anybody else like me. How can this be? I mean, I remember at Google, you know, I worked on the diversity team, and part of it was really helping the communities in that organization have as much impact as they could on products and things like that. Because when you really think about Google, as big as it is, roughly 2.5% or less are Black or Latino. And you start to think about the lack of diversity of thought. And so who is building products and who are they building for? And how do we make sure that they're building products for everyone? And so making sure that they are thinking about being intentional of bringing in the diversity of thought from different perspectives, different people with different lived experiences and things like that. So Latinas in Tech is more really trying to say, how do you help more women, how Latina women take on leadership roles, and how do you make sure that representation in these organizations starts to slowly get better? And how do you support them? Because yes, they may make it to, like, I made it to Google. I was one of a few amongst hundreds of thousands. But as great as Google is in supporting diverse talent, there's still a lack of community. And so Latinas in Tech and organizations like Alpha create that community outside of the organization to kind of help you like navigate and steer as well. So it's like the additional support system that you may not have within your organization.
And not an easy task, I know for sure, because, you know, the Black Commercial Real Estate Network, which I co-founded, and it's hard. It's hard to figure out like what people actually need to be successful, not just to get in the door, but to be successful once they're past that gate. And then it's just a hard thing to do. And especially these days, like, there's been a huge backlash against diversity.
Absolutely.
It's even though the whole thing has never been about like taking. Yeah, it's like, what? It's never about taking opportunities away from other people. It's all about helping people be successful at every level. And yeah, it's wild.
And I think it's important what you said is just like the reason it's hard is because we don't know what we don't know. And, you know, you get in there and typically you see you have these, like I talked early on, like I had this mentor in college who kind of took me under their wing. That mentor didn't look anything like me. And so a lot of the times you don't have that natural affinity with leaders or people there who are going to take you under the wing and help you navigate. You don't have legacy uncles or, you know, relatives that are like leaders in some of these organizations where you sometimes see that where it's like, oh, my Uncle John got me this job or got me this internship and he's going to show me the way because he knows how to navigate. He's already a leader in this organization. We don't have that luxury sometimes or that privilege to say, I know someone who's going to show me, tell me what to do, what not to do. We're having to kind of like get the bumps and bruises along the way. And sometimes they can be detrimental where they can stall your career. And so for me, I kind of was like, I need to make sure that I'm transferring that knowledge to others in masses so that they don't necessarily don't stall out. It might have taken me the better part of 2 decades to get into leadership roles at all of these organizations. How could I basically cut that in half for somebody else?
Yeah, sharing that knowledge and sharing that experience is something that's so important and something that we think about all the time, especially with the BCREN, but not just with the organization, but in general, in life. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we share this knowledge? And, you know, and that's a big part of what I'm doing with the show. When I meet people such as yourself that have this impressive career, a purpose behind it, a drive behind it. And if I can in any way find out more and share that with our audience, it's an honor for me to do it. So that's why when I said it's an honor for you to be here, I really mean it.
No, I mean, I would say equally, it's an honor to be on your show because you're democratizing access to information. And that's the thing, access and opportunity, it aren't necessarily always available for everybody. And so basically you with this platform and your podcast, you're giving it, you're opening it up to the masses to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for this, I want to get into your startup or your business that you're doing. Is it too early to share this, or are you ready to just let it out of the cage here?
Yeah, no, I mean, certainly we can certainly tease it. I mean, we've been somewhat in stealth mode for the better part of 6 months or so. But, you know, I had a successful, when I left corporate, had a successful kind of entrepreneurship journey and had my last company and exited that. But partly because we started seeing the tea leaves, we started reading the tea leaves of how AI was really kind of impacting the world. And the experiences that I had in all of these other companies where I was a bit of, I learned to reinvent myself a lot. And like I mentioned to you, the curiosity of seeing kind of problems coming to fruition and how do you solve them, it kind of shaped how I was thinking about AI today. And it wasn't necessarily hearing the stories that, oh my God, AI is going to replace people. What I started realizing is that this is another opportunity where change management itself is going to have to change. And where I started realizing that AI was changing the workplace faster than people could change. And so how, again, because my through line has always been helping people navigate these complex, you know, environments, how do you really design systems that let everyone contribute at their best leveraging AI? And so we, you know, my co-founder and I decided we were going to really focus on what we were seeing happening was that all of these companies started investing in AI. But what was happening is people didn't know what to do with it. They were saying, hey, here are all these tools. And people are like, what do you want me to do with it? And so there was a gap of how do you humanize AI for people? Because people were seeing AI as some sort of, oh my God, this is going to replace me. But what people don't understand is that AI needs humans to train it and teach it. And so my whole belief is that AI is not about replacing people. AI is basically the tool itself is not going to replace you, but people who leverage the tool are going to outpace you or replace you. And so you really have to start to think of yourself as reinventing the way that you do work. And so our company Flipwork is all about how do you flip work on its head, right? How do you flip the script on some of these limiting beliefs that AI is only for tech people, AI is for the coders or any of those things, but really getting people to understand how do you shift your identity to see yourself as someone who can leverage the tool and the technology that AI affords you, and how do you amplify your zone of genius? So again, it's that you first have to do the work and understand what is your zone of genius? What are you really good at? And how can AI augment that so that you can focus more on that? And so AI is one of those things that people are having a really hard time adopting to. And ironically, our theory is proving itself out only because the latest research from MIT, the research from McKinsey, where companies were investing millions, but 95% of these AI pilots are failing because they forgot to focus on the human aspect of how do you actually teach the tool to the human so that the human can adopt it. And so we're seeing atrocious adoption rates. Companies are saying, well, we gave them all these tools and nobody's using them. And it's like, well, they're waiting for you to tell them how to use it. And the IT department is saying, well, we don't know your area. We're not experts in your space. You have to use it in a certain way. So Flipwork is really kind of approaching it in three ways. We're getting people to gift themselves the time to really reflect and think about who am I in this world of AI and how might I leverage AI to reinvent the way that I do work. And so it's really kind of shifting your identity to say, you may not be a tech person, but you know how to use the tool. And so it's the new definition of hybrid is no longer kind of working from home or remote working. Hybrid means, are you leveraging AI as a thought partner? And so you are reinventing the way that you do work. The second part is once you kind of get used to adopting the tool, you're going to have to reinvent your workflows. The old playbook is no longer going to be successful. How do you rewrite that playbook and the workflows and everything to leverage AI to make sure that you are getting the best output and really compounding your impact to get out there? And then the third prong is, how do you sustain that change? Because we're creatures of habit, we're humans. And so you may use AI for a couple of workflows, but then you might find yourself falling back into the old way of doing things because that's what's comfortable to you. And you have evidence of being successful that way. But eventually, if you keep doing it the old way, you're going to get outpaced or replaced by AI. And that's the reality. And so getting people to really start to embrace the idea that AI is here and it's here to stay. It's not some fad, that you're going to really have to reinvent yourself. And that is really going to be what's going to help you become successful.
So as far as your business plan and role, because I do see that a lot of people that are hesitant towards adoption of AI, and for good reason, but some just for fear, some for ignorance and, you know, whatever. There's a lot, all the above. As far as like, what was your, is your business plan to reach out to like individuals? Is it companies? Like what is your focus for your customer, your client?
Yeah, great question. Flipwork is, we like to call ourselves the people operating system. We're helping companies realize ROI from their AI investments. And so we're focused really on helping the organizations. So enterprise, we've piloted the program with a few Fortune 50, Fortune 100 companies. But the idea is that we also wanted to target more of the mid-sized companies, because the big behemoths, companies that I've worked at, they have the money to invest in the change management and in hiring some of these big companies like Deloitte and all of those things. We like to call ourselves, you know, instead of Deloitte, kind of like Duolingo. It's just like kind of for these smaller companies that really need help of how do you help people even realize what it means to adopt AI in their organization? You know, how do you reinvent your workflows? How do you think about using AI? And a lot of it is where first people need to pause and understand, how am I doing work today? And how might I do work differently so that I can leverage AI and get better outputs and, you know, faster, better. And so some of it is getting people to understand, what is the high value work that you do? What are some of the things that you do that are uniquely you that AI cannot replicate? And then really starting to think about, do you really start to leverage AI like an artificial intern, AI, like an artificial intern? How do you kind of give them tasks that are the kind of gritty, grindy things that you were like, if I didn't have to spend time doing X, I could really spend time on doing the deep analysis, the discernment, the judgment, leveraging my lived experience and my areas of genius that I can make this, you know, a deeper, better, more robust solution or output. And so those are the things where we're starting to get people to understand, this is where you partner with AI to do some of those things for you, of the kind of, I would call it the low value tasks, and you freeing up your time to focus on the high value tasks. And so getting people to think differently in that way is a little hard, because you're asking people to unlearn something they've been doing for decades that has made them successful, and they don't want to let that go. There's a fear of, like, it's that old saying, if it's not broke, why are you going to try to fix it? But the idea is that it's soon going to be broken because AI is going to disrupt it.
Yeah. Well, it's so cool to hear your story and all the different things, and it makes so much sense. And even though you just kind of glanced over some of those behemoths that you worked at, you're like, oh, Google, Ernst & Young, and you kind of glanced over it. All those experiences and you realizing things and making change and your connections and the people first and all of that meeting AI, like, you are in a perfect spot to be the person at the head of this venture. I'm excited for you. I'm really excited for this.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate you saying that. You didn't, like you said, glossing over it. I mean, all of those experiences shaped me. But what I realized in all of those experiences is that it was kind of like same song, different DJ. It was like the same barriers, the same kind of issues, the same things are happening in all of these organizations. And there are really good people in these organizations trying to navigate, mitigate a lot of these barriers, but they've been there for decades. And so how do we really start transferring knowledge to people to help them navigate around them, over them, under them, through them? And it's platforms like yours that are kind of like democratizing access for people to understand, like, it's not just me, like normalizing, like, oh, this isn't just a problem I'm dealing with. Like, this is a systemic problem. Rather than focusing on there's a problem, and it's like, okay, well, then how am I going to navigate around it? How might I do something around it? And I think that's where the beauty of AI comes in, because I do think that AI, if you adopt it soon and you test and learn and you learn how to leverage it to augment your genius, you're going to find that it is going to, in some cases, level the playing field for you. It's going to help you gain more confidence in areas where you didn't know what you didn't know, you can ask the AI, what don't I know? Where are my blind spots? Help me fill those blind spots and close the gaps for me. And it gives you that confidence to move forward.
It's absolutely remarkable. Like everything that I've been doing with it, and I've been working in AI for years, got my AI business application certificate from Berkeley. And it's just every day I feel like there's a new innovative use for it that makes something better or easier or faster. It's unbelievable. So before we go, I want to make sure to give you the opportunity to like, because that was great what you just said about like the overarching like lessons learned and what you're doing and why this time is right for you to do what you're doing. Yeah. But is there any final note you want to give our audience? And also, I'm going to share all of your links and everything in the show notes, but this is a great opportunity for you to share parting notes.
Yeah. So, I mean, parting notes is that my through line, I think my success story has all been about reinvention. I've been able to reinvent myself for the role or the opportunity that was there at the time. And so I embraced change. And I think part of it was because I grew up as an Air Force brat and I was forced to like move around a lot and I just had to learn how to adapt. I do think that in this day and age, in this AI era, that being able to adaptability, agility, and not being afraid to pivot and embrace change is going to be a superpower. And so it's something that we all have to work on. So, and it's, those are the things that I address. I have a weekly newsletter and it's called III AI. It's a play on my Latino roots. Partly I was talking to my grandmother about my new company and said, Grandma, it's all about AI and technology. And she was like, ay, that AI thing. And she was like, I was like, oh my God, ay, AI. And I was like, that's the perfect, you know, people are afraid of AI. And so basically every week I share practical, inclusive tips and tricks on how do you use AI every day in the workplace, sharing prompts, introducing new tools, sharing stories of how I may have tried and failed and just transferring the knowledge. But it's a weekly read. It's 5 minutes. You can find it on my website. It's themonicamarquez.com and just subscribe to the newsletter. But you can also look up our company, flipwork.ai, and learn about what we're doing with companies and helping people advance and really try to thrive in this era of AI opposed to just survive.
All right. Fantastic. Monica, I will share all that information. Thank you again for your time. And I'm really excited about seeing the next steps.
Absolutely. And again, thank you and loved spending time with you. It was a wonderful conversation. And I hope we continue the conversation from here.
We sure will.